town hall, Valerie Bell by, versus the Farm Court, Genesis and Surgery, Representative, L. L. T. Benjamin Ford, Mr. Jonathan Rogers, who argues for the appellate, Mr. William Clooney, William H. Church Jr., who argues for the appellate.
Mr. Rogers?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors. My name is John Rogers. I'm an attorney from Weatherford, and I represent Dr. Molly Bell Fye. We've tried to highlight the pronunciation of that name in the brief. We are here today to ask the court to overturn a temporary injunction entered by the trial court in connection with a case involving a non-compete and a non-solicitation clause contained within Dr. Bell Fye's employment contract with Equine Sports Medicine and Surgery, and I'm going to refer to them as ESMS, so I don't have to spit out all those words accurately each time. I'd like to address 4 points out of our brief today, beginning with the fact that, and I'm going to just go over them briefly here, that the covenant not to compete, for whatever use it is, does not prohibit Dr. Bell Fye from practicing as a sole practitioner. It may prohibit, by its terms, her practicing in association with others, but not as a sole practitioner. Rule 683 requires that temporary injunctions have certain findings, particularly those that show why the injunction was entered, why there's irreparable harm, and how there is a nexus between the irreparable harm and the enjoined conduct. In this case, those findings are deficient, at least in regard to the non-compete. We're also going to discuss the fact that there is no evidence of a nexus between the interests that ESMS seeks to protect and the conduct which Dr. Bell Fye has been enjoined from undertaking. And lastly, we'd like to discuss the fact that the injunction itself, when one reads the injunction, it's overly broad, because Dr. Bell Fye can't tell what activities are prohibited, and because it enjoins activities that are not related to her employment at ESMS. Briefly, I want to hit it's the second issue in our brief, and that is that Dr. Bell Fye is entitled to practice as a sole practitioner, and that the non-compete does not prohibit that conduct. The exercise is something like diagramming a sentence. There are rules of grammar, and there are rules of contract construction that determine how you read this paragraph. And so I won't try to stand here and explain it. It is best read. But when you want to know, and what it does say in paragraph 15, it's in the employment contract, which is one of the exhibits or appendixes, that she shall not enter into or engage in a relationship. And then it goes on to describe the things that she shall not do in such a relationship. ESMS knows how to say, when they mean it, that you won't do that by yourself either. Prior to this employment contract, Dr. Bell Fye had a different employment contract with ESMS, and that's Exhibit 2 to the hearing transcript, and we referred to it in footnote 5 in our appellate brief. It says that she shall not engage in competitive conduct on her own behalf or with any other party. So the short of it is, the non-compete does not enjoin or restrict, her conduct as a sole practitioner, and yet the injunction does. An injunction.
But that's not really what she's doing, or she was doing at the time that this all started. She was working for.
That's absolutely correct, and she still is, Your Honor. But the injunction prohibits her from doing it on her own if she chose to do that. And that's not what the non-compete says. So it is over, when an injunction restrains conduct that is not prohibited by the non-compete, it's overbroad, and it's an abuse of discretion. Rule 683 talks about how a court, as a matter of form and as a matter of substance, must state in its findings why the defendant, or the applicant, will be irreparably harmed. Not just that it will be irreparably harmed, conclusory statements of irreparable harm have been found to be insufficient. If a amended, in this case the amended order, if the injunction does not comply with Rule 683's requirement that there are specific findings showing why there will be irreparable harm and how the injunction cures that irreparable harm, then it's void. It's not waivable. It's not a valid order. We have conceded in our reply brief that with respect to the trade secrets, there are two paragraphs that are at issue here, the trade secrets provision and the non-compete. We have conceded with respect to the trade secrets provision that there is likely at least one finding in there that will get them past Rule 683's hurdle. However, that same kind of finding, a specificity, a specific finding of how ESMS will be harmed irreparably by Dr. Belfie's competitive conduct is not to be found in the court's findings in the amended order.
Doesn't it say basically what they say over and over again, and that is that they're a teaching hospital and that they invest a lot of money in these interns and these people that come to train with them, and that not to allow them to use a covenant not to compete then punishes them financially?
They do say some of those things, Your Honor, but what they don't say is they invest a lot of money in it. They say that they conduct these things and that the failure to uphold a non-compete would cause damage to that type of program. But what they don't say is how it would damage ESMS. They don't say that it would cause ESMS irreparable harm because it doesn't show why not being able to conduct internship programs or residency programs would create irreparable harm, and then it doesn't show how that irreparable harm is thereby cured by such an injunction. So obligatorily, ESMS responds, yes, those findings exist in the record. But then they inject this concept of implied disclosure or implied presumed disclosure. And I just want to point out to the court that the cases that they rely on, Bell Helicopter out of this court, it's TNT Motor Works, and McLean out of the Austin Court of Appeals, number one, those are all trade secret cases. We've conceded at least the finding in the trade secret issue. So they don't add anything. And furthermore, I think that ESMS presumes that and by the way, the courts are nowhere near in agreement that this is an applicable doctrine and how it's applied all the time. But I think ESMS thinks that that's a substitute for a 683 finding. A finding is a matter of form. It's a matter of recitation in the order. It's a matter of explanation of why this injunction is being entered. It is not a substitute. It's not an excuse. This implied disclosure is not an excuse for the court not to make such findings. So if we were arguing that there is no evidence of irreparable harm in connection with the trade secret, they might that might come into play, but we're not. So there is no Rule 683 finding, and if there is no Rule 683 finding of why they would be injured if Dr. Belfi is allowed to compete, then the non-compete portions of the injunction are void. Once you get past the finding, is there a sufficient finding, then we have to look at the substance of the order and of the evidence. First of all, remember, this is especially with respect to the non-compete. In the Marsh case, the Supreme Court told us that unreasonable limits on the employee's ability to change employers or solicit clients, number one, it hinders fair competition, and number two, it hinders the mobility of skilled laborers or skilled workers. So in drafting the Texas Business and Commerce Code, Section 1550, the legislature said that these types of agreements are a restraint of trade unless they meet certain requirements. The requirements that they have to meet is they must contain limitations as to time, geographical area, and scope of activity that are reasonable and necessary to protect the interest. So there's a relationship between the interest and the protection. And we had this discussion in Centel Cellular versus Light for years about whether or not the consideration gave rise to the need for a non-compete. And that's actually not a bad analysis, except the Supreme Court shifted it in Sheshnoff and Marsh to say, let's don't look at whether or not that's a valid contract on the basis of whether or not consideration gave rise, et cetera, let's look at a reasonable nexus. What protection do you need? What is the minimum protection that you need in order to protect this identified interest? And it is the burden under Texas Business and Commerce Code 1551B, it is the burden on the applicant, or in this case ESMS, to prove to the court that these protections are reasonably necessary to protect these particular interests. Here they failed. There's no evidence in the record that she received any specialized training. She was given nationally standardized, nationally promulgated training. ESMS does not have a secret way to fix a horse's knee. That's the same kind of material and information that is in veterinarians' journals and the like. There's no secret here about how to fix a horse. The evidence conclusively established that within this 50-mile radius, I think at some point we're going to see this nice little target map, it's in the brief, within this 50-mile radius, that is the prohibited zone under the non-compete, they did not serve each and every horse owner inside that 50-mile radius. There were clients that there's no evidence that Dr. Belfi was introduced to clients other than the clients of one doctor, Dr. Hand. He's the one that testified at the hearing. There are three or four other surgeons at ESMS. There's no evidence that, there is evidence that there were a group of clients that used to be at ESMS and are no longer there because one of their surgeons left and went to North Dakota. The evidence conclusively established that many of these horse owners use multiple veterinarians. The record contains a description of the number of three or four of these big animal veterinarian clinics that are located in Weatherford. And a number of the clients of one use many of the doctors of the other. They do so on an emergency basis or they do so on a regular basis. And that there's evidence that conclusively established that Dr. Belfi brought about 10 friends to the practice while she was at ESMS, and that those friends brought with them several horses, 20 or 30 horses. Finally, there is no evidence.
There's no exception in that covenant not to compete of clients that you brought in, or patients that you brought in.
I get that. That's why I'm getting to this. Well, so once you have all of these, there's no evidence of this and that. Finally, this, there's no evidence that she took any data with her or she's in possession of any physical data. Then you go to 1551's requirement that you show what is your interest in these clients and how is the injunction protecting that interest. If they don't ever, if they haven't ever serviced a client in that 50-mile radius, what is their interest in keeping Dr. Belfi from doing so? If she, not through the auspices of their introducing her to a client, but she herself brought a client to ESMS, what is their interest in keeping her from servicing that same client? It's not because they introduced her to him. She knew that client. She brought that client. If she's working for this BVEH, Brazos Valley Equine Hospital, they also service a number of these clients. What is their interest in keeping Dr. Belfi from working on a client that her current employer already services? I see my time is drawing nigh, so I'd like to quickly flip, if I could, to the vagueness of some of these prohibitions. And they are at page 4 of the amended order. Chief among them is she is entirely prohibited from contacting or soliciting ESMS's customers or prospective customers. That's the definition. That's all we know. Dr. Hand testified that he had between 1,000 and 10,000 clients, and he couldn't say how many. There is no evidence about how many other clients that any of the other ESMS doctors had. And we don't know how we're supposed to find out who their prospective customers are.
People living within 50 miles.
Well, but that part of the injunction is not geographically limited. It's everywhere. So if they've got a customer in Houston, we can't service that customer in Houston, according to item D of the injunction. And going back to the 50 miles, Your Honor, there's three things about that 50 miles that have to be reasonable. Time, 18 months, location, 50 miles, and scope of activity. We've not contested the time limitation or the geographic limitation. What we're saying is that's a blanket prohibition in that 50-mile radius against doing anything but providing any equine veterinary services. And we say that is overbroad because there's a whole bunch of customers inside that 50-mile radius that they have failed to prove they have an interest in protecting. So I think my time is up, so I'll stop and save anything for rebuttal that I can.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Church?
The court will give me one moment.
You offering those as exhibits?
I am not. There is simply
I didn't mean that.
May it please the court. I want to start with the thing that is the most important to my client, which is protecting the very reasonable non-compete reflected by that 50-mile circle around their facility. That 50-mile circle shows why it's so reasonable and important. Their biggest competitor, where she went to work, BVEH, is within that circle. And Lone Star Park is within that circle. That sets the radius for our circle. Now, the thing that I think counsel keeps misunderstanding in his arguments, first to the trial court and then to this court of appeals, is the distinction between a non-solicitation agreement, which relates to the customers, and a non-compete agreement, which is broader than simply non-solicitation. That's why the Texas legislature passed what is called a non-compete act, 1550, as opposed to the Non-Solicitation Act. That's not what it's called. It's called the Non-Compete Act. Now, what is the difference between not competing and not soliciting? Not soliciting is a subset of non-compete. Not soliciting is she does know who our customers are, and the record is very clear that the vast majority of horses she treated in the period of time that she went to Brazos after leaving us were horses that she took from us. That is undisputed in the record, okay? But not competing is more than that. So let's talk about the rancher who moved to that 50-mile circus 4 years ago and for 3 years has been hearing how great ESMS is and how they are the best equine surgeons in the area. And a year ago, she bought a bunch of horses who are now entering their prime, and she needs to get care for them. And she has heard for 4 years, the amount of time that Dr. Belfi was an intern and then a resident with us. We may even have introduced her to this rancher. She's heard how great ESMS is, and now her horses are just reaching sports performing age, and she needs a sports vet. Do we have a protectable interest in getting that business? Yes, we do. We have invested all this time in marketing, in convincing her and the people in the area that ESMS is better than and different from the competition. We are board certified. We are the only teaching facility in the region. We're better than everybody else. We've spent all this time marketing it. And isn't it reasonable under the Non-Compete Act that the Texas legislature passed for us to say that when you graduate for a reasonable period of time, 18 months, less than half of the time you spent in training learning how to be a horse surgeon, within that circle, you won't open up shop so that now this new rancher who now needs services says, I want an ESMS doctor, but I want Molly. Because Molly's cheaper. She's less expensive.
You've described a hypothetical that you, I'm assuming, are arguing justifies the reason for prospective clients and future clients and all the language that's in the order. Let me give you a different hypothetical. Let's say my hypothetical is I've never owned a horse in my life and I know nothing about them, but tomorrow I wake up and I decide I can't live another day without a horse. I've never heard of ESMS. I go buy a horse and I say I need a sports veterinarian and I am going to hire Miss Belfi. You have no interest, no investment, no nothing in my decision. It doesn't play at all, but this order, the way it's written, as broad as it is, she can't work on my horse.
Well, she can't do that if she's in the reasonably defined geographic area, which is the 50 miles. And that's why the Texas legislature...
What is your interest in my business? It's not because I've heard for 4 years about how good ESMS is. It's just my... novice decision that I like her name, and that's the person I'm going to use.
She's closer to me.
Right.
It relates to the very promise, the exchange of promises that are at the heart of this particular relationship. This is not a situation in which we were looking for an employee and went out and hired her, and she got trained as a side part of doing her employment for us. This is a situation where a young lady wanted to learn how to be an equine specialist. And she came to us when she was rejected from every other school that she applied to, and she said, "Will you train me to do what you do?" We could easily have said, and what the record is clear on, if this is not enforceable in the future, will say to similarly situated people, "No, we will not train you." But what we said was, "Yes, we'll train you as long as after the training is over, for a very reasonable period of 18 months, you will not compete against us in that very narrowly defined geographic circle." And that is the legitimately protectable interest that we have. We do not need to train the next generation of veterinarians. The record makes it clear that nationwide there are only 5 people per year in the entire country getting into veterinary training programs with this specialty. We don't think that's enough to meet the demand of the different parts of the country that have horses and need them. We would like to be able to train people. We would like to be able to advertise ourselves as a teaching facility because we do think it helps our marketing and our business developments. But our very protectable, our very specific interest in this case is that we could very definitely have kept her from competing with us by not training her, by not allowing her to become an equine specialist, not allowing her to be a 3-year resident in our program. We didn't do that because we thought we had this contract with her return promise, saying, "If you train me for 18 months, I won't be an equine specialist in that circle." And let me make it very clear, that doesn't mean she can't be a veterinarian in that circle. She can. She can treat horses and other livestock. It doesn't mean she can't be an equine specialist. She can be an equine specialist anywhere outside of that circle. Let me also make it clear that under the standard of review, this court should not be substituting its judgment for the trial court's as to whether the 50-mile circle without holes is reasonable or the 50-mile circle with holes is reasonable. The fact that there are arguments on both sides under this court's prior precedent in Cobb versus K Publishing, in Trainter, in the Anderson-Kill Concrete case, if there are 2 lines of cases, both of which are viable, both of which support a result that the trial court could have found, that is not an abuse of discretion. As one of the members of this panel wrote, The question when looking at abuse of discretion is, did the trial court act without regard to precedent? And here, the trial court clearly did not. The two most apt precedents in place are the Battenkill decision, which is a horse vet case, and the Pro-Edge case, which is a cow vet case. And in both of those, there were geographic areas of prohibition with no exceptions, no limitation, and it was found that those were reasonable. And if the court goes further and looks at one of the cases that this court has cited many, many times as being a reasonable expression of Texas non-compete law, the Daily Instruments case. Again, the Daily Instruments case says you can have very broad, as long as they're reasonable, geographic areas of non-compete. And the question isn't what are the customers, specific customers that the employee dealt with. The question is what is the territory, the service territory that is governed that business does work in.
Well, an order can still be overbroad, even if it encompasses a small territory. You're saying an order can't be overbroad if the territory is small enough?
No, I'm saying that it can't be over. I'm saying it, that this court should not substitute its views for what is overbroad, for what the trial court found as it considered the record, as long as there is sufficient in the record to support what the trial court found. And what the trial court found here was that this is a subset of our service territory. If you look at the key language in the cases on geographic non-competes, the question is, what was the service territory? And the record here establishes that our service territory is much bigger than that 50-mile circle. The 50-mile circle is a subset of our service territory. So the question is that overbroad? And it's clearly not. So the question then becomes, should this court start tearing holes in that 50-mile radius when the trial court considered those very arguments and rejected them and concluded that it was, in fact, necessary to have the 50-mile radius, that it was, in fact, appropriate to have the 50-mile radius with no holes? Another issue that plaintiff's counsel or appellant's counsel brings up is this issue of, does the order somehow need to name all of the customers that she is prohibited from seeing? And I won't dispute that there are cases out there in which a court of appeals has found that it would be appropriate to name the customers in the order. But what I would point out is that there are an equal, if not greater, number of cases where the courts of appeals have felt that is not necessary. And the distinction between the two lines of cases is the names of the customers one of the things that the business is trying to protect and keep secret? And that's the case that we are in here. That was what the court understood and found. And in terms of counsel's suggestion that there's no way then for her to know who these customers are, that's not true under either the record or plausibility. One, she clearly knows who the customers are. She was introduced to them. But the record in the trial court also establishes that the way veterinarians do business will tell her almost immediately whether she might be at risk of violating her non-compete, because as both sides ask the witnesses and is in the record, what you do when you first see one of these horses is you take a history and you ask who's been treating this horse and what it's been treated for. And she would quickly find out, if she didn't already know, this is an ESMS horse. It's been treated at ESMS. She would know at that point whether it was something she could do or not do. So again, I go back to the idea of abuse of discretion. If there are valid lines of authority, two valid lines that are different, and the trial court hears the evidence, considers the record, and decides, I think this is the appropriate line of cases to follow. I think this matches the facts of this dispute better than the other ones. That's not an abuse of discretion. The trial court has not acted without reference to valid precedents. The trial court has exercised his discretion. He has said, in this case, I think this is much more like those lines of cases where the names of the horses is secret, the names of the customers is protectable, and it would defeat the very purpose of the agreement if I required them to name all of the horses she couldn't see so that all of their competitors could see them.
Let me ask you a different question. What is your response to their argument that the agreement, the way it is, or the covenant not to compete, the way it is it currently exists, as opposed to the first one that apparently may have been signed, limits her from only engaging in a relationship such as the one she's in, but and doesn't prohibit her from practicing as a sole practitioner?
I think it's just fundamentally wrong and misunderstands the legal relationships of a sole proprietor, or the word that they used in their reply brief that I think brings it home even more clearly is self-employed. That is a relationship. She can't be an owner or an employee of a competing practice. That is what the language says.
Owner, you're just jerking out of that sentence, because if you put owner in the context of that sentence, it still requires a relationship.
It does. And the relationship is that if she is self-employed, she is both the owner and the employee.
She has a relationship with herself.
She does, and that's the nature of a sole proprietorship. And if you go look at any of the case law defining a sole proprietorship, that's what it is. You are an employee owner.
Then why would you have had that first agreement that said it differently and made it sound like those are two different things?
We had the two agreements because they were entered into in different times and the client revised them. There was no intent to change the level of protection, and I don't think the language did that. Clearly, it says she's not supposed to be an employee or an owner, and as a sole proprietor, she would be both. And there is a relationship between that. If you look at John Rogers LLC, LLC is the entity, he's the employee. He pays different levels of taxes, one to the government, one to the state.
It says employees shall not enter into or engage in any relationship in a capacity similar to the capacity in which they have worked for the employer. So in other words, like working for ESMS.
She will not be an equine veterinarian as either an employee or an owner.
Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Unless the court has further questions of me, I have nothing further to add.
I'd like to understand the reason for two agreements, Mr. Rogers.
There was a point in time, Dr. Belfi worked for 3 years, the last 3 years, as a surgical resident. Now, y'all forgive me, I am not well versed in medicine or veterinary practice about the difference between interns and residents. But there was a period of time before this 3-year contract that she was an intern, I believe is the correct word. And when she started this residency, they offered her and instructed her to sign a new contract that specifically related to DVM surgical resident. I think that's the title of Appendix B, perhaps. It's one of the two. There was an earlier contract, it's Exhibit 2 in the trial transcript, and that period of time dealt with her time there as an intern.
And that's not applicable.
It is not, because the current contract has superseding language that says this contract supersedes any other prior written oral understanding.
So the applicable agreement is the one that is entitled, like you said, DVM Surgical Residency Employment Agreement, that is dated the 29th day of May.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming here from where you came from, and for your arguments and your briefs and your cases submitted, and we will adjourn for the afternoon.